Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now our 30 Issues in 30 Days fall election series continues with what you might call the fight between the head of the federal government and federal workers. This is kind of Donald Trump in his old business role as boss versus federal workers as employees. In August, Trump said he would be canceling an annual pay raise for government employees for the coming year. In his letter, Trump said the federal agency budgets couldn't handle the pay increases, which, if you think about it, is surprising considering how well Trump himself says the economy is doing. If the economy were in kind of record good shape, as Trump touts and tweets and at campaign rallies, and we do have lower unemployment now, technically, than any time since 1969, why wouldn't there be enough money to continue annual raises for civilian federal employees as scheduled? There's apparently enough money to give military service members a 2.6% pay boost, but he was going to go for zero for civilian federal workers. Now, there's a wrinkle in this story in the last few days. With the Senate and House looking towards some tight midterm election races, congressional Republicans seem to be at odds with the president on this one, passing spending bills that do include a 1.9% pay increase after all. Now, the raise is just one aspect, this raise debate, one aspect of Trump being tough on the federal workforce. Back in May, for example, he issued three executive orders that made it easier to fire federal employees, you're fired, and make it harder for them to unionize. A federal district judge struck those down in August, but Trump appealed at the end of September, so those issues are in play. Here to explain where the tension between the Trump administration and its federal employee workforce lies and put it into the context of Trump's larger labor policies that also include the private sector is New York Times labor reporter Noam Scheiber. Noam, welcome back to WNYC. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So Trump is, you know, he'll be the first person to talk about how well the economy is doing. So if it's doing so well, shouldn't there be enough money for scheduled pay raises? What would he say?
Yeah, so I think if Trump were being honest in his heart of hearts, he would concede that that this doesn't have a whole lot to do with money. In addition to the reasons that you mentioned about the economy, earlier this year he signed a, late last year he signed a $1.5 trillion tax cut, which would many times overpay for the raises that the federal workers were seeking. So I don't think this is about money. I think this is really about a deeper suspicion of the civil service, of the federal bureaucracy. We've seen that suspicion crop up in a variety of ways. Different members of the administration, like the president himself, have talked about a deep state and posited that it's out to get him. You've had his former top advisor, Steve Bannon, talk about how the deconstruction of the so-called administrative state was a goal of the Trump White House. Mm-hmm. And when I started reporting on this, I talked to a lot of people, some of whom were, pretty close to Trump, who saw this as a real mission. They wanted to sort of continue some of the policies that Republican governors like Scott Walker had enacted on the state level, essentially kneecapping state workers in their state. And I talked to the former House Speaker Newt Gingrich, who was very open about the point of this. He said, look, you have 97% of the contributions of the State Department, 99% of the Justice Department, that all went to support Hillary Clinton. The elected president of the United States should just have the ability to enact his policies without a bureaucracy that's opposing him. And Gingrich is someone who the White House had consulted on precisely these policies on, right, kind of reforming the civil service. So I think they're very clear about the goal of this, and it doesn't have a lot to do with money.
But when we talk about the mass federal workforce, we're not talking about policymakers who make the regulations that comprise the administrative state that Trump and Bannon want to roll back, that burden on companies. These are just people going to work, doing their jobs, whatever those jobs happen to be, for the most part, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, these are doctors and nurses at the Department of Veterans Affairs. They are the people who help you get to the bottom of an issue with your Social Security check. They're people who, you know, process federal student loans. All these things are what we're talking about here. And, you know, that's a lot of people beyond the kind of assistant secretaries and deputy secretaries who are appointed, to sit on top of the bureaucracies.
And yet the politics of this are that Trump thinks he can rile up the base by getting them to go, oh, those federal employees, those doctors, those nurses, those postal workers, ooh, something like that?
Yeah, well, I think there are a couple layers of the political considerations. One is just, you know, as I mentioned and as Gingrich told me, that, you know, whatever the politics of this, he actually feels like a significant portion of the bureaucracy is out to get him. So if you feel that way, politics be damned, you're probably going to try to do something about it. Yeah. But I do think, you know, there are ways in which they think that the politics may dovetail with a longer-term agenda. I mean, if you take Social Security in particular, we are... thanks to about 7 years of congressional budget caps, we now have a situation where we have way more retirees and Social Security benefit recipients because of the retirement of the baby boomers, but we have about 10% fewer Social Security Administration workers. So we're really starting to strain that program quite, you know, considerably. It's a wildly popular program, but think about what the long-term effect of that kind of strain on that program is. It's going to make people... it's going to take a longer time to get your check. If you have a problem, it's going to be harder to get to the bottom of it. And over time, you might start seeing people getting frustrated with Social Security, saying, you know, this program really isn't working for me, starting to be more open to maybe turning this over to the private sector. And it just so happens that a lot of people in Trump's administration are actually pretty sympathetic to privatizing some or all of Social Security. Mm-hmm. So this, on some level, can dovetail with longer-term policy goals in addition to just kind of sticking it to the bureaucracy in the short term.
I wonder if we have some federal workers listening right now. Let's open up the phones for any federal employees out there. Tell us about your relationship with your employer, the people of the United States, the federal government. What are your thoughts on the Trump administration and its attitude to federal workers? Are you seeing anything in your agency, whatever it is, to justify the suspicion that you're all out to get Trump and thwart his agenda that our guest was just laying out from their point of view? Do you feel like that there have been changes in the workplace designed to be hostile to your workplace quality of life since Trump took office or anything else? 212-433-WNYC for any federal employees in any department who might be listening today. 212-433-9692. As we continue to talk about Trump and the federal workforce as an issue in our 30 Issues in 30 Days fall election series right now with New York Times labor reporter Noam Scheiber, 212-433-9692. Let me take a step back, Noam. How many federal workers are there altogether? Do you happen to know?
I'm embarrassed to say no. Not off the top of my head. Yeah,
it's either hundreds of thousands or millions, right?
That's right. No, it's in the millions. Yeah.
Yeah. And to be fair, foregoing federal employee pay raises, as Trump wants to do, is not unprecedented. Even under Obama, between 2011 and 2013, federal workers received no annual pay raise. Of course, that was the bottom of the financial crisis. But why then, and what would be different today?
Yeah, well, this is a great point that you mentioned. So the August letter that that the president sent to Congress is a kind of a pro forma letter. It has to do with sort of arcane budgeting rules. So basically, if the president doesn't send that letter, then a certain pay raises kind of automatically kick in. And if he wants to have any sort of discretion over those raises, then the president will send that letter. And so Obama sent that letter and often asked for somewhat lower pay raises. If you'll recall, toward the beginning of the Obama administration, Obama and his budget director, Peter Orszag, actually made a point of also trying to freeze pay raises. And at that point, I think it was sort of a political calculation that they were spending a lot of money on the stimulus, and they were getting criticized from the right on out-of-control deficit spending, and so they wanted to sort of signal that they were being fiscally responsible, and that was a symbolically powerful way of doing it from their perspective. So yes, this is a move that has bipartisan antecedents.
And just in the last few days, Republicans in Congress seem to have taken a different position from the president on pay raises for federal employees. They've included a 1.9% pay increase, which I think is the same as last year's, into new spending bills. Why the political difference between Republicans in Congress and the Republican president on this?
Yeah, well, there are, I have colleagues who are smarter on this stuff than I am, but I think the bottom line is, if you look at the congressional map, and especially the House map, a lot of the districts that are in play are more affluent districts, more educated districts. Those districts either have, federal employees in them, like in the Washington suburbs, or there are people who are sort of sympathetic to the idea that government should work and that federal workers shouldn't be impoverished by doing their public service. So I think it does have to do with the congressional map, and especially the places that are in play where Democrats are poised to make some gains. Brian, I should just go back and just update two things. It was exactly, or not exactly, but it's about 2 million workers who would have been affected by Trump's executive orders, 2 million federal workers. And just on the Social Security Administration point, I should say that there are actually good reasons to want to reform the civil service, particularly uh-huh. in Social Security. There's long been an issue at Social Security with technology adoption and management being frustrated that there are certain things that they wanted to do to make the Social Security Administration workforce more efficient that couldn't be done. So I think there are clearly benign explanations. The question is, given this president, what he said about the administrative state and the deep state, whether those are the explanations that are guiding this.
Where does the post office and postal workers come in? Because I noticed in the news there were a number of protests by postal workers a few days ago against what they described as the Trump administration goal of privatizing the post office.
Yeah, I think that's handled separately from this order. So those negotiations go on their own track.
Let's take a phone call from an ex-federal employee, Tom in Little Silver. Tom, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yeah. Good morning. I used to work for the Internal Revenue Service before I retired, and this situation with Trump is no different than it's been going on with the Republicans in Congress for years, if not decades. Back in 1998, I believe it was, they came up with the IRS reform, and this was like basically trumped up issues that they, used as an excuse
so to
attack the IRS. And, now they're doing the same thing by reducing the manpower and woman power at the IRS. And anybody who works currently at the IRS can tell you that this set of proposals and all the changes have, really wreaked havoc on the morale and the workforce there. And that's basically my comment.
Same old, same old. Was it different under Democratic presidents than Republican presidents?
Well, I always expect that an administrator of a state or the federal government is going to have issues with raises and, anything that's going to cost money, to the federal government. But it's usual. Many of these things are driven by Republicans, even if in some cases Democratic presidents go along with them. It's, usually mm-hmm. driven primarily by Republicans.
Thank you for your call, Tom. I appreciate it. My guest, Noam Scheiber, labor reporter for The New York Times. Noam, there's also these executive orders that Trump gave earlier this year that have been struck down in court, but they're being appealed. So these things are in play. One of them is to replace job security protections for federal workers with something more like at-will hiring practices. Another is to increase management's authority to reward high performers and hold low performers accountable. Another one is to bargain with federal employee unions for no more than a year. That would certainly put a crimp in collective bargaining, because if you know that the boss can just delay for a year and then they can impose terms, you know, that would certainly be threatening to the collective bargaining process. What's the job security protection situation now, if you know, and what is Trump trying to replace it with?
Yeah, so there are a couple of dimensions to this, but I think that one of the ones that the employees are most concerned about is the period of time in which you have to improve your performance if you're singled out for underperforming. The current rule is that once you're singled out, you have a sort of structured improvement plan, and you have 120 days to get on that plan and show improvement. Trump proposed shortening that from 120 days to 30 days, and people up and down the civil service and the unions that I've spoken with feel like that means that you're basically done. You know, that 30 days is not really much of an opportunity to right the course. So that is a big concern. That was sort of unilaterally imposed in July after these executive orders took effect. Then, as you said, the federal judge struck down those rules in August. The Trump administration has now appealed. But what's interesting about those orders is they're written in a very clever way. And what they say is they're written as kind of goals, you know, guidances. They urge the different departments to seek these things in negotiation. They don't mandate any of these changes. And the benefit of that from the administration's perspective is it is very difficult to prove whether management negotiators at any bureaucracy are doing this because the president told them to, or because they just want to do that. You know, that's the goal that they happen to be seeking in their own negotiation. And several experts on administrative law told me that that could end up saving these orders. And even if the orders are struck down, the management at each of these agencies could continue to pursue the same goals and just say that they're doing so of their own volition. So the orders and the whole initiative was constructed in a very sophisticated way.
Anna in Port Jefferson, a retired postal worker, she says. Hi, Anna, you're on WNYC.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I just really called to sort of voice an opinion. I'm a retired postal worker, and I understand that the Postal Service is obligated to give the government $5 billion every year, and that was under the guise, I understood, for funding retirees' health benefits. I just think the Postal Service gets a bad rap, and with the climate out there, they're taking away our teeth to bargain under the collective bargaining agreement. And the public really doesn't understand that none of their tax dollars goes to fund the Postal Service.
If none of the tax dollars go to fund the Postal Service, then why does the federal government want to drive a hard bargain with you?
Right.
Okay. I was asking a question, and you were seeing it as an answer to its own question. Do you know the answer, Noam?
I don't. I mean, as with Social Security, I think there's an ideological dimension to this, a sense that, you know, why should the government duplicate something that the market can do? So I think often if you you see a policy that doesn't seem to make sense on narrow economic grounds, then that layer of ideology may get you a long way in figuring out why it's happening.
Let me do one more. David in Stamford, a current Justice Department employee, he says. David, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. Mine was more of just a comment. The speaker or the guest that you have on is talking about how there's little economic sense for the Trump administration to cut, pay increase for federal workers.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree there. It doesn't hold much weight. But I think from a political perspective, I think Trump has been, you know, campaigning on this drain the swamp. I think it's an easy victory for him to claim it if he can get this cut for federal workers, because it can be seen then as a, you know, a tactic that he is reducing, you know, expenditures in the federal government. But something that's interesting, at least within my agency, is I work in an agency that has quite a few conservatives, and I think they're motivated now by taking up that justification, that political justification that Trump is using. And it doesn't matter if they're, you know, having to deal with the economic impact of not getting a pay raise. They see it also as, you know, oh, he's fulfilling his promise. And of course, if we read this with the upcoming elections coming up for the Republicans, but maybe mainly more for him in the near future, I think this is a great political tactic for him. It's just interesting to see how it is motivating even conservatives that are having the economic consequences of it.
David, thank you for chiming in. And David in Stamford is going to get the last word on our 30 Issues in 30 Days Fall Election Series segment on Trump versus the federal workforce. And we thank New York Times labor reporter Noam Scheiber. Noam, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.